Good morning. I actually called Wendell and said, hey, let me go first tomorrow. I want to get this over with. I thought all week on what I was going to talk about today. And when I woke up Saturday morning, an epiphany hit, you know. So I want to talk about taking the Lord's name in vain in movies and television. Some of us remember when nothing made it to the screen until the censors approved on the content of the language. It seems today the censors have gone to sleep. Oh, there are ratings, but that doesn't seem to do the job. Children especially are exposed to filthy language and bedroom scenes numerous times a day. Personally, what bothers me the most is when someone takes the Lord's name in vain, and when that happens, it literally turns my stomach. I just don't understand why movie and TV writers think to have to slip it in at least once, especially in the movies. One of my favorite movies, Avatar, has a family audio track that removes all offensive language. And to me, that makes the movie much more enjoyable to watch. Even John Wayne's The Cowboys has a young boy that stutters, take the Lord's name in vain, which was totally unnecessary. Also, it seems every Star Trek movie has Dr. McCoy take the Lord's name in vain. There again, unnecessary. Being a movie addict, I could go on for hours telling of scenes in many movies that could have one or two phrases changed or removed and not hurt the plot. When our kids were little and we traveled in the car, I would quiz them on Christian holidays and what they were all about. And Tracy would say, Dad, you should be a preacher. Maybe if I read the Bible half as much as I watched movies and televisions, I may have Wendell's job. But what I guess I'm trying to get across is don't let the world desensitize you through movies and television. Thank you.
I heard a quote somewhere that inside every man is a little boy pretending to be an adult, feeling lost and pretending to have everything together. I don't know about guys, but I feel this way all the time. Like I'm playing house and wife and friend and fumbling it all. But maybe it's all part of the tapestry of life that draws you back to a place where you can truly lean on God and learn through the intricately woven joy and grief how to use lament as a way to hold on to him when everything seems as if it's crumbling and will never be right. And our world doesn't understand lament and tries to teach us to hide our grief. We have a hope as Christians that they cannot have, and this hope causes sorrow as we navigate this sin-filled world. But they think this hope precludes sorrow. Quite the contrary, however, we grieve the sin and its effects that touch us so deeply. Because they want something other than the grief they see in their own mirrors. They can't believe that we are different, that Jesus' tear-stained face as the man of sorrows can bring them the comfort and peace for which they so desperately long. They cannot see God's faithfulness through the pain because the two seem so at odds. I was blessed to grow up in a home where my parents taught me about the faith from my cradle. We were members of a church for as long as I can remember, and the importance of going regularly was stressed. I learned from my parents, my friends' parents, and my teachers in both church and co-op the importance of being sure of my faith and being able to give proofs and reasons for it. I accepted Christ very young and have since strived in his help to live for him and bring him glory in all I do, though I often fall far short. Not only did they teach me truth, but they gave me language for all the joys and sorrows of life. They taught me the basis for the lament and how to take it to God. I was also encouraged to do what I love and was in ballet for 11 years. Because of all my dance training, music has always touched a deep place in my heart and soul and helped me process things. I once wrote a song inspired by Ann Sherrible and a songwriting contest to put on my favorite Christian children's site, and I accidentally set it to a piece one of my pianists played in ballet class. It was my ballet teacher who encouraged me to sing it for my class, as she said, "For God, and don't worry about what the other girls think." Not long after that, I realized that the dancing that poured from my soul should also be used for God's glory. As the oldest of seven, I helped with my younger siblings from a very early age, and when my mom had to start working, my sister and I had the responsibility of looking after five young ones. I also helped with homeschooling the youngest three. The hardest thing I had to live through as a child was the death of my grandma when I was 11. She was my best friend. The year I had to start ballet late because my dad was out of work, and a year later, I had to stop completely because we just couldn't afford it anymore. I found that each hardship in life prepares us for the next one, and each is more severe than the last, sometimes making us wonder why we thought the previous things were even hard. This perhaps indicates growth and maturity, but I've had to learn and remember to give both myself and others grace in seasons of hardship. The two hardest, longer-lasting things in my life have been learning contentedness through singleness and infertility. I still distinctly remember when my mom explained to me where babies came from and thinking, man, why would anybody want to do that? As well as watching my first brother be born and noting by myself that having a baby was not something I ever wanted to do. Well, these are perhaps natural responses of an 11 and a 5-year-old respectively. My super romantic children-loving self decided at some point in my teens that I wanted both a husband and children. I have somewhat too much of a propensity to daydream, and they seem to become plans somewhere along the way. I'd meet someone in high school, we'd be married by the time I was 21 or 22 and have a large family. But I didn't meet anyone in high school or in the years that followed. But many of my friends did. Member after member of youth group and ballet class started getting married. There were times I had to really prep before going to a wedding or bridal shower. I surrounded myself with other single friends who were also struggling with the weight, and we encouraged and prayed for each other. The most helpful thing anyone said to me during this time was a friend who told me that we needed to get on the bus and go, which she elaborated to mean that instead of waiting around for someone, we should spend this time strengthening our relationship with Christ to become the sort of people we were looking for as spouses, not specifically to find a spouse, but because it's what we're called to do as believers. The more I thought about this, the more sense it made, and I wanted to be close to God. So I tucked my list of qualities I was looking for into my journal and gave it to God. Then I determined to move on, whether or not I found someone. At some point, I tucked a dream on a shelf and moved on. I would always be single, I thought. I'd become very close to God, taking him all my joys and sorrows, lamenting in my loneliness, and turning to praise when I found that he sat with me and took the loneliness away. During this time, two things happened that left impressions on me. A friend of one of our pastors adopted an embryo from a research facility to try and save it from destruction. When they told us about it, I thought I'd like to do that someday. Maybe I'd even do it if I never found a husband. Then I attended the wedding of a friend who I learned at the reception had met her husband online. I went home and told my mom, and she said, "You should do that." I was like, "That's weird, probably not that safe," even though my friend had just married a pastor. No, hard no, never doing that. Then there was a young man who started coming to our church, and I was sweet on him. He eventually told me he wasn't interested. At this point, I was having a great deal of temptation and decided that maybe I wasn't gifted with singleness. So, because I hadn't met anyone, I tried to give this online dating thing a try. Daniel was one of the first guys they matched me with. I had this idea that the guy needed to start the conversation, so I waited. Several guys sent me questions and we had conversations, but no one stood out. Finally, I decided if I was going to talk to Daniel, I should just do it. So I sent the questions and we started talking. When we had talked as much as you could on the free side of the site, I paid the fee so we could keep talking. We met and got to know each other. He and my brother Christopher share a birthday, and Christopher wanted him to join us for his birthday lunch. I would take each of my siblings out for lunch around their birthdays. So we invited Daniel to join us. The night before their birthday, he asked me to court. I went home that night and pulled out the list of qualities that I had tucked in my journal. It was like reading a description of him. I was so happy I didn't sleep that night. The next night, I took my brothers to youth group and ended up falling asleep in the middle of it. I later explained to Nate that it had nothing to do with him. It was all down to a lack of sleep from my excitement the previous night. Aside from my four closest girlfriends, Nate became the person who would hold me accountable during my courtship with Daniel and on our engagement. He would ask how it was going, were there any red flags, were we making sure to save ourselves for the wedding night. It meant so much to me that someone I didn't know super well would do this. This is a sort of accountability we should have in the church. The great joy that came with meeting, courting, getting married after a long wait is something I've never heard expressed by anyone. You hear people talk about how God was with them in inexplicable ways as they drew near him in sorrow or difficulty, but never in joy. It was such a great joy that I couldn't hold it all within myself. I had to give it to him. Then with his help, it got bigger, and as we held it together, it continued to grow. I imagine this to be only the taste of the joy that we'll experience in heaven. But perhaps in part, this joy was born from having learned in my lonely waiting period not only to lean on God, but to hold so tightly to him through lament that when the reason to lament was gone, I had overflowing reason to praise him fully. Then too soon, we found out we wouldn't be able to have children. I was just learning to be a wife, but this was something I don't think anyone could prepare anyone for. Watching helpless as your spouse process is a very personal grief that makes him feel unworthy of you is absolutely soul-crushing. When his uncle and aunt died, I was able to comfort him. He came to me and sought comfort, but this grief caused him to push me away. I wasn't ready to grieve infertility yet. I was still just enjoying being a wife that I'd wanted to be so long. And if you've been through infertility, you know that every month it hits you again when you realize again that you haven't gotten pregnant yet. What I grieved now was my inability to comfort him, my marriage that seemed in shambles because of this great grief. If I showed sadness over anything, it would send him spiraling. So I determined I wouldn't. The unintended consequence of this was that I would often cry at other times when I wasn't around him, sometimes in more exposed places than I or others would have liked. I had to find a way to help him, and I didn't know how. I didn't know who to ask or what I needed to ask to get him the help he needed. He started saying things that left me fearing for his life. I used to watch the clock at work and pray when I knew he was getting off, knowing he was home for 2 hours before I got off, hoping he would be there when I got home. I was afraid to leave him alone some weekends too. Took my sister seeing a post he made and saying, "Hey, he's really depressed, you need to get him help," for me to realize what was going on, probably just because I was too close to the situation. I felt guilty not seeing it myself, guilty that I couldn't help him after all. Didn't I promise to be his helpmate? I prayed that he'd find the comfort in God that I had, that he would learn to grieve in a healthy way, and that we could process this together. I often felt like we were drowning. Somehow it's much harder to trust God on behalf of your husband's well-being than it is on your own. In this, I had another struggle as well. The night we got our final diagnosis, my gut reaction was to ask for prayer. The first response I got was essentially to be told that we needed to get over it. This not being helpful, I shoved it deep inside, determined to forgive. But I've had a long struggle to realize that what I actually heard in that statement was, "You're not important enough for me or for God for this to be a matter of prayer." This brought me to Job. He had a culturally expected response to his grief, though we didn't. Don sackcloth and ashes. What was ours? We felt the children we had talked of were real, but not actually having physically lost them, we had no hope of holding them one day in heaven. It was therefore as if we were grieving the loss of an unbeliever. The one thing Job's friends did right when they came to sit with him for seven was to sit with him for 7 days in silence and just let him feel. But that's where it ended. Instead of allowing him to grieve and lament to God, they pulled him into a theological debate over whether or not he had sinned. I haven't had this, but rather some who've tried to tell me my grief wasn't worth anything, which also isn't helpful. I've had a long journey of my own to remind myself that this isn't the nature of God, that Christ is ever ready to weep with us in our grief, and to get back to the place where I was before, where I could freely lament to him. And not only lament to him, but ask others also to lament on my behalf. There was a long, long period when it was very difficult for me to ask for prayer because of this that I was struggling with. And it didn't matter whether it was for me or someone else. Even in the middle of this grief, there were joys to celebrate, sweet reminders of God's faithfulness. If you've ever seen Inside Out, there's a beautiful scene where the girl and her family have just moved, and there's a fight between joy and sadness because a memory that used to be purely happy about her hockey team is now tinged with sadness, nostalgia, I suppose. But then Joy realizes that in order for the girl to move past this, she needs to feel both joy and sadness from the same memories and now from new experiences as well. And now there's many memories that start to come in that are, instead of pure joy or pure sadness or pure anger, are tinged with one or two emotions. That's so much how we feel. We all wish joy could have the upper hand and infuse all of our lives, but the reality in this life is that the world is often bittersweet, which makes the stamping out of tears in heaven a sweet hope. Finally, he started to come out of his deep depression. We started being more social again. We got our house. Then he decided to take a part-time job. All at once, everything I'd been bearing inside came tumbling out, and I crashed hard. I got so down and depressed. One night when he was working late, I was alone and depressed, and I heard a whisper saying I should kill myself. My first gut reaction was no, that would be dishonoring to God. I couldn't even pray in that moment, but knowing what I did gave me truth to hold on to. I messaged several friends asking them to pray for me. I could feel when they did because the darkness lifted, even though I wasn't able to pray. The darkness lifted and I was able to pray myself again. This is the single scariest experience I've ever had in my life. The depth of the spiritual battle that I felt in those moments was overwhelming. It's only by God's grace and goodness that I was able to resist the temptation. I encourage everybody to know truth inside and out so that when the deepest, darkest hour comes, you'll have an answer to turn away the temptation. I've always loved the story of Elijah on Mount Carmel, but I've recently discovered I identify way more with what comes afterwards. The prophet asks God to take his life so Jezebel can't. We are often most beat down after our greatest mountaintop experiences. I found my husband and experienced the greatest joy in my life, followed by the deepest sorrow, followed by burnout. Elijah had just defeated the false prophets. Now he's burnt out. But God says, "Eat this bread and go to sleep." still sage advice. Will I ever get over this? I hope not, because it would make me less vigilant to stand if it happens again, and less compassionate to others going through it themselves. But here's what I've learned. Find your people and hold each other accountable in Christ. The people who let you cry on their shoulder and when you're done, help you think in truth and reality again and let you do the same for them. The ones who truly share your pain will be able to more deeply share your joy. Take the time you have now to learn truth and compassion and cement it in your soul so when darkness comes, you have the answers to make temptation flee. And when you're in that place where there seems to be no hope, maybe what we need is a snack and a good sleep. In the morning, we can get back on our bus and keep going. I've also learned about the sacrifice of praise. The hardest time to praise is when I feel like I'm being swallowed by waves, completely engulfed and drowning. But I've learned that because praising God includes reminding myself of truth, it truly is the anchor I need. Even if it means putting on a song and stopping through the first several, then dancing a few, then singing. There are some songs that touch me in such a deep place that I can hardly sing them here, though they bring me comfort and peace and the joy they speak of. At those times, the child inside me wants to join Nava and Maddie as they dance in the back, totally oblivious to what everyone thinks. I truly find amazing the mingling of joy and sorrow one can hold at the same time. So through the relentless storm and endless battle, I can say hallelujah even here. There are seasons in life. One season was dancing. Then single, almost surrogate mom to my siblings. Then being there for my husband while he grieved. I once told a friend I felt stuck. Then I realized that my service was hidden where I was, helping my family. First my siblings, and now my husband, though no one but God saw it, day by day, quietly showing them the love of God and the worth they have in Christ by staying when many would leave. And somehow, just doing this, I've realized I've left an impression on some. Daniel's buddy once told me that he sees our marriage as one of the strongest he's seen, only next to three other couples, including his parents, who dealt with separation from the military and the sickness of his dad. I don't feel like I'm anywhere near that yet, but by God's grace, I hope to be one day. After all, I'm only doing what I vowed to do on my wedding day, to cleave to my husband for better or for worse. We've had a lot of worse. Now we're ready to serve as a couple. But where is our place as a childless couple? If no attempt we make to adopt is ever successful, that's what we have to face. Somehow getting married is pretty much dried up offers of unique babysitting. It seems the place of the single person is babysitter, but somehow not for the childless couple. We want to be the fun aunt and uncle who do things with our friends' kids, who take them for the evening so you can have an impromptu date night. But somehow not having kids seems to put up a block. And the friends that we have, while very dear, are not the same type of friends we would have if we were bonding over our children's friendship. Will it be easy? No. But a lot of things aren't. But it'll be worth it. And now I know when the tears surprise me while I hold my friend's beautiful new baby. Though I thought it was okay, I have friends who will let me heal by hugging me as I hug the baby and cry. Life is hard in this world as Jesus said it would be. I almost missed the greatest joy of my life because I was afraid to get on the dating site. And though it is also mingled with the deepest sorrow, I wouldn't change it. Moving on is never easy. But as a wise friend has said, after she also missed an opportunity, the next time a big, beautiful, messy, scary opportunity presents itself over my life, I'll consider the joy of my yes first instead of the safety in my no.
Good morning. Before I start, I just want everyone to know you can either blame or thank Chad for all this because he's kind of the reason I found this church. I missed all the neon signs and online advertisements somehow. Again, thanks, Chad. So today I just wanted to talk briefly about words of encouragement and the difference that they've made for me, specifically here at Tech. You guys have been a great church family these last few years that I've been here, and I look forward to many more. I'm thankful that The Brink is going through Colossians this month, as I was inspired to read it so I could speak intelligently about it to Sophie as she's going through it. And I happened to, on this passage I felt was pretty pertinent, Colossians 3, 12 through 14. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Bear with each other and forgive one another if any of you has a grievance against someone. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. And over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. So certainly there's a focus on being forgiving with one another in this passage, but without a doubt, Paul is also stressing the importance of our attitudes with how we communicate with one another as well. The kindness and empathy of those in this church has been hugely influential on me. Growing up, I found a lot of value in being known as the smart one. I was valedictorian in my high school class, excelled in pharmacy school, undergraduate first in pharmacy school. But all along, I certainly dealt with my own set of insecurities. Making the transition out of the school setting was pretty difficult for me. It probably didn't help that I was in pharmacy school until the age of 26, so that's like 22 years of being graded on things. You don't get grades in real life. That was a really tough realization for me. It's hard to evaluate how you're doing on a day-to-day when you don't see that A, B, et cetera. So for a long time, I dealt with imposter syndrome when it comes to feeling like a real adult, for lack of a better term, whatever a real adult actually means. Building relationships with others is a bit of a challenge for me, which seems funny because I really am an extrovert with a job that has me talking to people all day long in retail pharmacy. But the fact is I do have a hard time with change and adapting to new situations. I've come a long way in this area, and being here at this church has helped me along the way. And I'm especially thankful for the people here because I've had to deal with some challenges with church in the past that could have dissuaded and discouraged me from finding a church home. So going all the way back to the beginning, at like 4 years old, I was raised in the church, going to Lakewood Park Church and School. I went to the school from pre-K through 12th grade, so 14 years in one place. I went to Awana, Christian summer camp, youth group, the whole nine yards. My dad was on the worship team. He was a deacon there. He was the high school principal of my school for a few years. Then out of nowhere, my dad was laid off when I was in eighth grade. No warning given, no justification for it. The whole situation made it impossible for my parents to continue attending the church that I'd grown up in. It was very challenging for me. It took a while for my parents to find a church again, but I never really felt connected there. After graduating high school, Robin and I began attending Church of the Good Shepherd. It was our church home for several years. We continued attending when we could while we were away in West Lafayette, as we could not find a theologically grounded church committed to digging deep into the Word. We do think we stumbled into a cult accidentally for a few weeks. that's definitely a story for another time. I don't have time for that. When we moved back from West Lafayette, coming back to CGS was wonderful. It felt like home again. We were well on our way to building those genuine relationships with other believers and feeling like part of a family again. Then everything changed a few years ago when it merged with Central Ministries. There are a lot of changes made in the church after the merge we weren't told about beforehand, and frankly, we were uncomfortable with. So we had to make the difficult decision to leave the church. And this is where Chad comes in. When we came to Tech, it was understandably difficult for us to transition. Leaving a church that felt like home is hard, but me and my family felt welcome here from the very beginning. Sometimes it's the small things that matters. Saying hi in the hallway, asking how I'm doing. I can't really point out one person or one specific thing that was said, but the point is it did not take long for me to feel accepted. As everyone knows, here we have some high-energy kids, to say the least. I'm thankful for all the times we had to take them in the back hallway so we could bond with the other parents disciplining their kids. Again, it makes you feel accepted. Being a parent to those high-energy kids has challenged me with my speech. James chapter 3's challenge of controlling your tongue feels quite acute when dealing with some of the situations that rise in parenthood. What I say to my kids matters on a level that seems more critical than when talking to some others, but the truth is what we say matters to each and every person. My kids humble me in this area as well, in particular Cassie. That girl is better at finding ways to compliment and say kind things to others than any other person I know. We can be at the grocery store, she'll compliment a complete stranger on their hair or shirt. She's always telling me what a wonderful dad I am. So if you ever need encouragement, just track her down. She'll have something nice to say. That sort of willingness to love on others with our words would be my challenge to you today. Maybe you've noticed a quality or an action in someone that you've been meaning to speak to them about. Maybe you want to build your relationship with another member here. I'd encourage you to talk to them. Go out to lunch or invite them over sometime. Who knows what sort of difference it may make to them. I know the connections here have made a huge difference for me. Thank you.
All right.